The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello, I'm Ollie Mann. Welcome to another edition of Tech Weekly. Coming up, how the war against extremism went digital. After the events in Paris last week, we'll look at internet radicalization, what it means, how it happens, and what, if anything, we can do to intervene. And
we are anonymous. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
As hacktivist communities Anonymous and Binary Sec declare cyber war on ISIS, we'll discuss the battle for hearts and minds online and whether attacking on the digital front can really do anything to threaten them. I've assembled a veritable think tank to discuss this with me today. Alex Krasadomsky-Jones from Demos, Charlie Winter, formerly of the Killiam Foundation, and Sasha Havlicek from the Institute of Strategic Dialogue. And from The Guardian's tech desk, our very own digital whiz kid, Alex Hearn. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. ISIS on the internet. It's not just about savvy hashtags. Increasingly, they're moving to encrypted messaging apps to communicate and organize. Alex Hearn is with me from the tech desk. Alex, I've been hearing a lot about Telegram. What's that and why is it being flagged up a lot in relation to Paris?
So Telegram is a competitor to WhatsApp. It's a messaging app which comes from a Russian entrepreneur who started Russia's Facebook, VKontakte. Initially, Telegram's big selling point was that, unlike WhatsApp, it offered encrypted communications. They called them secure chats, which were end-to-end encrypted. That means that a message that I send from my phone to your phone is encrypted in such a way that only your phone can open it. Even Telegram can't. These days, that's actually quite a standard feature of messaging apps. Not only Telegram offers it, but now WhatsApp themselves do, as well as Apple's iMessage. But when Telegram launched, it was really the first mass market app to promote itself purely on this feature. As a result, you know, one thing that is quite appealing about encrypted chats is that state surveillance actors cannot look in on them. There's been a lot of talk for a long time that groups like ISIS would eventually move on to Telegram. And recently it seems to have been happening, but interestingly, not the switch that we expected. They're not, as far as I can tell, using it instead of SMS communications broadly. Instead, they're moving from public social networks like Twitter onto Telegram. Telegram now has a public channel feature, which is essentially similar to Twitter. It lets you send messages and they can be read by all of your followers at once rather than simple one-to-one conversations. Encryption itself doesn't actually seem to have played much of a role in what we know so far about the planning of the Paris attacks. In fact, the only technological lead that I've heard the police refer to so far is a simple SMS, entirely unencrypted, sent using 30-year-old technology, which is what led them to the dawn raid that happened on Wednesday morning.
But today, the day of recording, we've seen Telegram completely change their policy with regard to IS. I suppose they'd argue they never had a policy with regard to IS in the first place, but now they do.
Absolutely. So once ISIS moved on to Telegram and started using its public channels, and immediately following Paris, Telegram clearly realized that these public-facing accounts were not a thing that they really wanted. So they took action and they closed, 89 accounts over 12 channels, which at the scale of Telegram is quite a big move. Obviously, for Twitter, that's a tiny fraction of the amount of accounts they have to deal with. But for Telegram, this is a relatively sizable change from their previously hands-off, we're a small company, we can't do much approach.
It's interesting, though, that for a lot of people, they'll be hearing about Telegram for the first time now, and therefore it'll be kind of linked forever with this event, rather like BBM is with the London riots, you know, whether that's justified or not.
Although similar to BBM, Telegram's massive. A lot of people already use it, just as a lot of people already use BBM. It's one of those things where almost you use it avidly or have never heard of it.
Okay, so if what IS are doing on social media isn't necessarily all encrypted and isn't necessarily all that sophisticated, then are they perhaps, masters of social media as we've been led to believe. Alex Krasodomsky-Jones is from CASM, the Center for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos, and you've been researching political extremism. How have their tactics, IS, how have their tactics evolved using social media recently? And how sophisticated are they?
They're not that sophisticated. I mean, I think it came to everybody as a big shock that terrorists were capable of using Twitter, when in fact that's almost ludicrous, right? These guys have grown up, they're young, they've grown up often in Western countries, they've grown up with this technology. So for them, building an app, as they did early on, or posting a YouTube video or sending a tweet is as easy as it is to you and me. Obviously, they have evolved. We've seen a move towards sort of additional emphasis on encrypted communications. But, you know, even the move to something like Telegram, this is nothing new. Al-Qaeda have produced their own encryption software for years. And of all the people in the world to have an interest in encrypting their communications, I don't think it should surprise us that people like IS are doing so and are taking an interest in it and are sharing the knowledge and the know-how as to how to do it.
And what about the companies and the corporations that, just because their software is being used, sort of are implicit in those kinds of programs being developed? And there's something hilarious, isn't there, about, you know, kill the infidels for Windows being released when you see those kinds of things. You think, well, at what stage does Microsoft not say, no, you can't do that?
Yeah, that's the difficult question. I mean, there are a lot of arguments to say that, you know, for every bad person that's using Tor, the Onion router, which is a sort of more secure internet browser, or any kind of VPN, which is a way of protecting your sort of browsing location, there's a good person using it. You know, for every terrorist, there's a gay rights activist in Uganda or a human rights activist in Turkey. So focusing on the technology itself is often a bit counterproductive in this instance.
And a lot of what is being shared, we understand, although I personally have never clicked on any of it, is propaganda videos, beheading videos, and the rest. Charlie Winter is here as well. Charlie, you're a senior research associate for Georgia State University's TCV initiative, and formerly were with Quilliam watching a lot of this kind of stuff all the time and analysing it. How has the propaganda changed? How has the online propaganda changed that IS are sharing?
In a lot of the media coverage we see of IS propaganda, it focuses on kind of the really violent stuff, the beheadings, the people being burned alive, that kind of thing. In the summer, to try and get round that narrative, because for anyone who looks at this stuff on a daily basis, that's just not the case. But to get round that narrative empirically, I archived everything that came out within 1 month, and there were well over 1,000 different units of propaganda. Photo essays, magazines, proselytizing material, theology documents, that kind of thing. And there are only 19 of those things that focused on violence. So what IS has, which no other group does have to this extent, is a really big focus on civilian life. So the kind of normal stuff, roads being swept and electricity pylons being extended, that kind of thing, to the really strange stuff, birds being conserved in eastern Syria, visits to the zoo, things that really try to build up a really comprehensive image of life in the Islamic State Caliphate. And this is something which, while, of course, all other jihadi groups have propaganda, and a lot of them, for example, Al-Qaeda in Syria has this, they focus on the civilian aspect of life as well, but nowhere near as much as IS. And that's because IS is really trying to sell a story. It's not just selling the fact that you can go and join it and then kill some Syrian soldiers fighting for Assad. You're joining it to change your life. It's a practicable alternative to your current life, your current status quo.
What do you think is the prevailing image they want the West to see, though?
Well, the prevailing image they want the West to see is violence and this kind of image of threat, of intimidation. The prevailing image they want their friends to see, their sympathizers, their supporters, their potential members, is this kind of utopian millenarian ideal of what it is to be living under pristine Islam. And there is a real focus in the West on the violent side of things. They're playing Western media very, very well. And it's sad to say that certain newspapers that I won't mention, they really cultivate it. They look for the really violent stuff. They know that it'll make a good headline. They know that if they use a clip from the video, thousands of people will go to that article and go onto their website. So there's a kind of cottage industry of using IS violence to create clickbait and kind of spread it around Twitter.
But then whilst that clickbait is on the open web, Alex from Demos, I imagine it actually becomes easier. Of course, it's easier to analyse for you, but it's also easier for the police and you know, the anti-terrorist services to be looking at it as well. And there's a lot of discussion at the moment about the surveillance bill coming back. What do you think the repercussions are going to be of all of this conversation around Paris on that?
That's a really difficult question. I think this is the surveillance bill will obviously gain momentum as a consequence of the Paris attacks, and I'm not necessarily sure that that is a bad thing. I think, admittedly, there is I think a lot of skepticism around the way bulk interceptions and bulk collection of data will work, particularly when it comes to dealing with people who are encrypting their messages. But if we expect our police forces and our security services to have the capabilities and have the tools to be able to intercept messages when they are encrypted, so for example, hacking a phone, or by just moving purely back to human intelligence, we need to kind of have a legal framework for them to do it.
Coming up, we look at some of the groups trying to stem the recruitment by extremist groups online, and how is ISIS increasingly targeting women to join the fight in Syria? That's after this.
If you've got a mobile business, you need an easy way to take multiple payment types with one integration. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more. Braintree also has quick, knowledgeable developer support, so there's help whenever you need it. The Braintree V.0 SDK. One snippet of code and you're all set up and ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. To find out more and for your first £30,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
Okay, so that's some of the reasons as to why this stuff is attractive to those whom we talk about being radicalised. What can we do to intervene with those individuals at risk? An organisation who is looking at this is the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. They've set up the Against Violent Extremism Network to counter extremism on the web, and its CEO, Sasha Havlicek, is with us now as well. Sasha, tell us about this network and how that works, first of all.
Can I just come to this point about sophistication? Because we've talked a little bit about how the technologies that they're using are not quite so sophisticated. It's true that they haven't invented anything new. They're using what's already out there. But I think it bears noting that the strategies, their messaging, their branding, their marketing strategies are extremely sophisticated. Their peer-to-peer communications, the sheer magnitude of the messaging put out there on a day-to-day basis, not just through their official channels, but through sort of networks of distribution. And I think that can't be ignored. And so when we're looking at the problem, we're really looking at a gap between something quite extraordinary that's happened with ISIS's use of marketing and communications technology, sort of new media. One of the things that's important to remember is that it's not just the barrage of content. They do very nuanced engagement with young people who may be at risk. I mean, you may remember the story that came out in the New York Times about Alex, a young girl in America, in Washington State, 23 years old, lonely, lived her life online like many young people. And there was sort of every day, in answer to her questions about the caliphate and about Syria, there was this incredible sort of one-to-one engagement with her, 6 hours a day, caring, loving, sending her gifts, making her feel a sense of great belonging and worth. And that kind of one-to-one engagement is happening in a much bigger way than I think we've clocked. And it's that starts to radicalize. And we know that because of this network of formers that we work with, and you've asked about AVE.
Right, so what do you do?
So this is the thing. Those deep insights about the ways in which people are radicalized and, in fact, de-radicalized, of course, comes from the people who've gone through those processes. And we've set up now, AVE is the biggest global network of former extremists in the world, with the help of Gen Next Foundation and Google. And the idea really is that while tech is one part of the problem and the solution, if we want to compete with what they're putting out there, you can't do it without credible voices and voices that understand the problem from inside out. And so what we've been doing is trying to put together, if you like, the expertise, the know-how, the understanding of the problem, the mapping of the problem, the credible voices, and then the tech and communication strategies that can actually amplify those.
So not that dissimilar, really, to banks and financial institutions employing the hackers who tried to hack them. It's a controversial thing with this, though, isn't it? Because one of the big sort of talk radio call-ins at the moment is, if you go to Syria, should you be allowed back in the country? Never mind, should you be working with Google?
Well, we do know that former extremists have a particular role to play. People who are coming back from Syria, of course, will be very, very different profiles. There will be those that are disenchanted, disillusioned, that may be on a path to disengagement, de-radicalization. But it's a long-term, that's a pipeline that takes some time to achieve. People don't de-radicalize overnight. I would say that people who left before the announcement of the caliphate to go and join Syria, much more mixed bag in terms of their motivations of going out there. And the constituencies that we've seen, some of whom sort of still stuck in Turkey, who were greatly disillusioned, having gone out primarily with humanitarian causes, I think are people that we must be engaging more in the counter-narrative. But I think, there's also people who've been stopped at the border who are undergoing disengagement, de-radicalization processes. Their voices are very important, not to mention people within Syria who are experiencing this firsthand.
Sasha, how do we actually stop people from stepping over that line and becoming radicalized?
The spectrum of radicalization is broad, and you need different interventions along that spectrum from upstream to downstream. One thing I'll mention is a program that we've trialed called One to One, which essentially is engaging young people who express strong sympathies with extremist views. And engaging a former extremist directly with that person online, taking online what we know can work offline in terms of walking people back from the edge. We thought we'd get, I don't know, maybe a 10% engagement rate. It's been approximately a 60% engagement rate to date with this pilot scheme, which just gives you a sense of how thirsty many of these people are for a conversation. Right now, nobody's talking to them except for the extremists. So there is a potential with engagement of this kind to do something much bigger. We do need to scale that kind of programming. We also need to build the machinery to compete with their content, which, as we've heard before, is sophisticated and ours is not.
And a really interesting thing that appears to be coming up in the research is that increasingly IS are targeting women in this country rather than men. Why and how?
Why? I mean, perversely, I think, IS, like other extremist groups, understand the value of women as the social and cultural transmitters, if you like, within society. If you've got women on board, their project is not just to have a fight, but to build a state. And for that, you need women, you need the rearing of the next generation of jihadis, and they're central to that. They've employed very targeted peer-to-peer, women-to-women, girl-to-girl communication strategies in this space. And while young women are prohibited from fighting with ISIS, the activist role they are given is in the online space, and they're doing that prolifically. So there's this enormous amount of female-oriented propaganda. I should say, in particular in this space, there's absolutely nothing really being done in the counter space. We've now started to work on female-oriented counter-narrative engagements and one-to-one engagements, which can prove particularly successful, but that is still, again, a drop in the ocean.
And it's to do with that thing you alluded to earlier, which is motivation, isn't it? Obviously, if your motivation is to build a caliphate and you don't care if you're going to die for it, then you're prepared to invest 6-7 hours to try and radicalise someone. And if your motivation is, oh, it's quite nice living here, don't do that, it's quite hard to muster up the same amount of strength. Charlie?
A really good way that I've heard it referred to is as an asymmetry of passion. So you have people in Islamic State who are really doing this. They really believe in this. They're doing it 24/7. They get up in the morning, they think about what they're going to do in terms of disseminating propaganda or looking for people to bring into the curve, that kind of thing. But then on the other side, there, as Sasha's just said, there's not the same thing that reflects that. And what we need to try and do is mainstream it, build it up so people do it of their own accord. They're not kind of incentivizing it in a way that doesn't make it just the remit of think tanks or governments.
And what about the role of the Muslim community? Because to my knowledge, none of us in this room are practicing Muslims. Is there a problem that actually, you've just talked about, obviously, some people who think of themselves as Muslim who went out to be extremists, Sasha, helping. But imams online, groups like that, say we need to do more as a community to help. Is that right? I mean, does a Muslim voice carry more weight in this conversation? Or if you're on the process to being radicalized, actually, do you just think, well, they're not Muslims anyway?
I think it really depends on the constituency that you're targeting. I do think it's incredibly disingenuous, the conversation about why hasn't more happened, why aren't voices rising up. I mean, they have been. They haven't had the resource, the investment to build up capabilities to do this kind of communications work in a concerted and professionalized manner. You know, Charlie's talked about the passion gap. There's a kind of activism gap which comes about because these people who join these groups do it 24/7. People going about their day-to-day lives with jobs don't have the time to do it. There needs to be compensation for that, not to mention the fact that they've got way bigger financial resources than we do on our side. But no question, the credibility of the voice is absolutely vital. And so depending on which part of the spectrum of radicalization you're talking about, those voices, those credible voices will differ.
I mean, Alex from Demos, I imagine there's a kind of groupthink with social media, isn't there? Where, you know, you post up a picture and lots of your friends pile in and say, like, great, well done. And however graphic that image is, in a way, I imagine it becomes even harder for someone to then come in and say, not sure this is a great idea. Have you thought about this?
I mean, that's the benefit of working with something like Facebook and Twitter. And we heard a little bit about Telegram earlier. One of the things about Telegram in the open channels before they were sort of blitzed yesterday was that there was no room for counter speech. So at least on Twitter, you can reply. Or at least on Facebook, you can reply. On Telegram, you can't. So I think the structure of the... And this is perhaps one of the areas where the internet companies and the social media providers can really make a difference, is if you can provide the digital structures, the capability on your website that allows for counter speech, effective counter speech, and shares effective counter speech, there may be something we can do on the technological side to take one credible voice and amplify it online.
Yeah, that amplification is something obviously that IS supporters are very good at, isn't it? Can we just talk, actually go back to the tech of this, because we are on Tech Weekly. How does that work? Because a video goes online, people say it's abhorrent, take it down, it gets taken down, and yet it's mirrored all over the place. Just in rudimentary terms, how does that video get there and keep coming up again and again and again?
This is something that is going to change with the new active posture of Telegram towards IS, but... Since the channel function was added, Telegram became the kind of place behind the front lines of IS's information war, where stuff would be uploaded and circulated to whoever was following said channel, and then it would be transferred within minutes onto Twitter and then circulated by hashtag. So then once it hits Twitter, you have thousands of people, maybe not thousands even, but hundreds of really, really active people who are literally just spending all their time watching out for these new links, watching out for this new content. They download it immediately, or they get it off Telegram and then upload it as much as they can on YouTube or other file sharing sites. So that is something which there's a fair amount of disruption which is trying to push back against it. Twitter and Facebook, lots of social media companies and that kind of thing are really taking a really proactive stance. But it still is very, very easy to access this stuff.
It appears to be on the open web, most of this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, two problems, I think, with the takedown approach. One is the sort of whack-a-mole problem, is that there's just so much of it and the referral approaches are very slow and so on. Once it's out there and it can be shared across platforms, it's sort of out there. I think the second thing that we found with research that we've been doing, we've got the biggest data set on women from the West who've joined ISIS, following their social media lives, if you like, over now more than a year. What we found is that women whose accounts have been removed invariably have a bigger following, are more influential in their second or third online lives, in their second or third online accounts. And I think that needs to be watched very closely, because we may be promoting a sort of online martyrdom.
Okay, well, talking of taking things down, another twist in the tale since the attacks in Paris is that the evangelist hacking group Anonymous have released another in their series of videos declaring war on IS and promising to hunt them down, albeit digitally speaking.
Hello, citizens of the world. We are Anonymous. In the aftermath of Friday, November 13, 2015, France is shocked by the events caused by terrorism in the capital. To defend our values and our freedom, we are tracking down members of a terrorist group responsible for these attacks. We'll not give up, we will not forgive, and we'll do all that is necessary to end their actions.
IS have responded to this by calling Anonymous idiots. Now another affiliated group, Binary Sec, have also claimed they'll start acting against IS online. Alex Hearn, firstly, are Anonymous idiots? Secondly, will they have any success in this?
It depends what you define as success, first of all. I mean, Anonymous is inherently limited in the tools they can bring to this. They are an online organization. They can they can and do hit ISIS online. They have taken down websites through DDoS attacks. They have taken control of Twitter accounts, which are, you know, protected with a weak password. All of the sort of things that you think of as low grade bread and butter hacking, they do to ISIS. They also have acted as a large crowdsourced organization for reporting accounts to the platform owners. So 5,000 YouTube videos have been taken down after reports from anonymous and affiliated groups. I think 100,000 Twitter accounts. They are providing a lot of the manpower behind these efforts. But at the same time, the question is whether any of that really helps. You take down a Twitter account and another one springs up seconds later. You take down a website and you can rehost somewhere else. The difficulty Anonymous has is proving that the large numbers they've gained for low-level successes are having any effect in the wider war.
They've also been publishing actual addresses of people, haven't they? Not just IP addresses, but their home and street addresses.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's it's a classic Anonymous thing where you start going, is that quite on? You haven't verified these. I mean, you know, if we at The Guardian got information like that, we would go through several further steps before publishing. Anonymous don't. Anonymous never have. Doxing is one of the tools in their trade. Doxing, which is the term for dropping documents on someone, releasing information you found out about them. They did it to the Ku Klux Klan earlier this year. And they also do it to people who have very little reason for anyone to hate them, but who have ended up on the wrong side of a war against Anonymous. In this particular case, Anonymous and affiliated groups like BinarySec and GhostSec say they're working with the authorities as well. And what that seems to mean largely is before they put the email these names and addresses up, they email them to someone at the FBI and consider that their job done. At some point, someone's going to be on that wrongly, either because someone signed up for a website using a fake name and address, or because they were misidentified because they have the same name as someone else in the same situation. This isn't hypothetical. I have been doxed by a group as not Anonymous, but another online group which uses doxing as a tactic. I've been doxed in the past as a Paraguayan engineer named Hernan Carasella. They thought that Alex Hearn was just a pseudonym. This happens all the time. As far as I know, Hernan is absolutely fine. You know, these are not precise tools.
But, I mean, let's not beat around the bush here. It might lead to some real-world vigilantism. Sasha, might that actually put some wannabe terrorists off from these websites, which is Anonymous's intention? Is there a grain of some effective action there or not?
I don't think this is the sort of thing that will put off a wannabe terrorist. I think the commitment is, you know, once it's there, it's there. And on the contrary, they want a good fight. You know, the fisticuff piece of this is an important piece. I do think, obviously, there's a lot that can be done just purely in the tech space in terms of disruption. So in the negative space, but that cannot be the only way we address this. We need a proactive competition strategy, and that requires us to combine the tech and amplification tools, as I said, with the sorts of messengers that can actually have an impact on the radicalization problem.
Alex from Demos.
Yeah, I think disruption is one thing. But I think intel is the second. And I think what we could really do is to put the people who have the tech skills in contact with the people who have the counter-radicalization skills. Because on the one hand, you have the people who have the capability and the skills to hack a website and deface a website on the one hand, or who can break into a forum and gather intelligence on a massive scale. And on the other, you have people who want to contribute to the counter-radicalization and want to spread positive messages, but primarily the intel coming into them is slow. It's written by academics, where a paper's written once every 6 months, which is too slow. We need a sort of daily updating feed driven by technology, driven by people who have their tentacles into all of these different forums. And I think that is where the people who have Anonymous' skills could really contribute to this.
Yes, and we'd invite them to come and help us. Yes, please.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to have to end because we've run out of time, although we could continue to talk about this for hours, I'm sure. Thank you to all of you, Sasha Havlicek, Alex Krasadomski-Jones and Charlie Winter. Alex Hearn as well from the Tech Desk. Pleasure to have you back after being in Dublin. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer is Alana Chance. Natalie will be here in your ears next week. Until then, bye-bye. For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.